Have mercy on us, O Lord, have mercy on us, for at a loss for any plea, we sinners offer to thee as Master this supplication, have mercy on us. Glory to the Father, and to the Son, and to the Holy Spirit.
Glory to Jesus Christ. This is Bo Branson, and in this podcast, Skylar McManus and I discuss a paper by Dale Tuggy in a special issue of Theologica, for which I was guest editor. We discuss whether St. Basil had a successful response to the charge of tritheism, and the ways in which Saints Gregory of Nyssa and Gregory Nazianzen did or did not differ from Basil's views. In particular, whether they identified the one true God of John 17, verse 3, with the Trinity or with the Father. We began our conversation with a prayer and a discussion of the reasons for the podcast. Heavenly King, Comforter, Spirit of Truth, whatever we're present and fill us all things, Treasury of good things and Giver of life, come and dwell in us and cleanse us from every stain and save our souls, O gracious Lord. This is a sort of follow-up podcast that Skylar and I are going to do to a podcast that we did with the London Lyceum. We had prepared some things to respond to the paper that Dale Tuggy has in Theologica, where he talks about kind of his account of the development of doctrine. We prepared a bunch of things to talk about. We didn't really get to finish a lot of our thoughts. The conversation kind of went on some tangents, so we thought that we would just kind of do a separate podcast here so that those of you know people who are interested can hear what our response is. So I'm going to start out, I guess, and just talk about the different narratives that Dale talks about in his article and clear up some maybe misconceptions about what my point of view is. And then after that, Skylar will talk about some of our criticisms of his argument. So first of all, Dale talks about three different narratives. He calls one of them the Catholic narrative. I'm not sure why. And then he calls mine the Western misunderstanding narrative. And I'll talk about that and why that's kind of a misnomer. And then he calls his own narrative the Nicene development narrative, which I think is also a misnomer. So we'll just go through those briefly. The Catholic narrative, as he calls it, I'm not sure that any scholars actually believe, and I'm not sure why it's called Catholic narrative, but it's basically a sort of naive view that the doctrine of the Trinity in its full glory, you know, has just kind of always been there from day one. It's in the New Testament, was in the early church and so forth. And that there's been no change or development or elaboration in, I guess, in any sense. I don't think any scholars really would say anything like that. So it's kind of something you can set aside, I guess. He calls my view, I guess originally he called it the Western fall and corruption narrative. And then one of the reviewers kind of complained because he actually read my paper and said, well, he doesn't say, you know, Branson doesn't say anything like this. So my view doesn't have anything to do essentially with the West, and it doesn't have anything to do with a misunderstanding. So I think it's an inaccurate or non-descriptive sort of title. To kind of contextualize it, my motive in releasing some video casts a couple of years ago, 2018, my motive was to refute basically the argument that Dale has in his podcast 189. So in podcast 189, to simplify, to get to the heart of the argument, he gives an argument that just says that the New Testament identifies God with the Father. To elaborate on that, there's a lot of times in the New Testament where the word God is just kind of thrown out there, and it's, you know, there'd be no way from the context to know whether it's referring to the Father or the Son or the Holy Spirit or the Trinity or what. It's just kind of a generic use of the word God. But in the cases where the context kind of makes it clear who we're referring to, 99.9% of the time, it's clear that it's referring to the Father. And there's about 12 times, I think, in the Bible where
Jesus is in one way or another referred to as God. Most of those cases are cases where it lacks the definite article, which is kind of a technical point we can I've gotten into in other podcasts. But the point is, his point is sort of that if the New Testament were really Trinitarian in a standard way that you might think of it, that would be surprising, right? You would think that either it would clearly identify God with the Trinity, or that it would be kind of equally divvied up between the three persons. So it'd be sometimes God refers to the Father, and like 33% of the time it refers to the Son, and 33% of the time to the Spirit. And he says that's not what you get. It looks like the New Testament just uses the word God to refer to the Father. His second premise is that all forms of Trinitarianism just by definition identify God with the Trinity and not the Father. And then he concludes from that all forms of Trinitarianism then are in conflict with the New Testament. So notice there's two kind of assumptions going on there. One is that Trinitarians who say that the one God is the Trinity aren't using the word God in a different sense. So there's one sort of background assumption is that this is not an equivocation. The other thing, of course, is he says, well, just by definition, Trinitarianism says that the one God is the Trinity, and it doesn't say that the one God is the Father. There's just no form of Trinitarianism that would do that. So my point in responding to him was to say that's not the case. There are forms of Trinitarianism, perfectly orthodox forms of Trinitarianism, that just identify the one God with the Father. And then they just say that the Son and the Holy Spirit have the same nature. They have the divine nature. And the one God is just the Father. And there's your answer to why there's one God. So all I have to do, right, is say that there are forms of Trinitarianism that work that way, and they're perfectly orthodox. I think that historically the fact is that the first person to ever identify God with the Trinity instead of the Father is in fact Augustine. And that's not me saying that because I hate Augustine or I think that God has a particular affinity to a certain geographical region. Point being, it's not because I think that God cares about geography or something like that. It's just that is actually a fact. And that's a standard claim that anyone in patristics would make. So for example, I just listed here Lewis Ayers, who I think no one could possibly accuse of being anti-Augustine. In his book on Augustine of and the Trinity, page 100, he says, "This summary of Trinitarian belief also offers us Augustine's first use of the phrase Trinitas quae Deus est, that is, the Trinity which is God, a phrase not found in his predecessors," right? So Ayers is making that claim himself. He goes on that page to say, interestingly, the phrase is only once used by Augustine in his homiletic corpus. So only in one homily or sermon does Augustine ever say the Trinity which is God. But it's used frequently in the De Trinitate, in two letters closely connected with that work, and in his later anti-Arian works. Its absence from sermons and from the record of his public debate with Maximinus, who was an Arian that he had a public debate with, suggests that Augustine saw the phrase as at least needing careful explanation because of its direct identification of Trinitas as Deus. In other words, Trinity is God. While Augustine's standard practice seems to have been to refer to the Father when Deus is used without further qualification. So here we go again. I mean, no one's going to say Lewis Ayers just hates Augustine and he's anti-Western or something, but he's even pointing out that, you know, Augustine's the first person to do this. And even when Augustine does it, he only does it kind of within this technical treatise on the Trinity. And in his homilies, his normal practice is to refer to the Father as Deus. On page 103, a few pages later, he says, he, Augustine, is also the first Latin to state simply that the solus verus Deus is the Trinity. In other words, the only true God is the Trinity. So again, he's the first person to do that. prior to that, the only true God was always identified as the Father. So I'm not sort of, you know, saying Augustine is, there's something magical about Augustine. It's just, it seems to be a fact that he's the first person to make this identification. And my point in saying that is two things. Number one, you don't even get a verbal identification of the one God with the Trinity until Augustine. And that's in the early 5th century that he's writing. So the first two ecumenical councils come and go. Athanasius, the Cappadocians all come and go, and God is still just the Father. Now, is this a misunderstanding? Is it a fall in corruption? I have no opinion on that. I have no concern with that. I don't know if Augustine read the Cappadocians and misunderstood them, or if he just didn't even read them, or if he read them and understood them, but had a disagreement, or he had some different ideas, or, I mean, it could be anything, right? Or what I think is really more likely, honestly, is that he's just using language differently. He thinks this gives him a good response to some Arian arguments and so forth. But anyway, regardless of what that might be, I mean, whatever your opinion on that might be, let it be whatever you want. My only concern is to say there are Orthodox formulations of the doctrine of the Trinity that say that the one God is the Father. And I also want to point out that actually the entire response that Dale is given is entirely a red herring. So it's completely irrelevant. Because suppose that it was the case that Gregory of Nyssa and Gregory Nazianzen actually make this identification earlier. Well, Dale already admits that St. Athanasius and St. Basil identify the one God with the Father. So he's already given me that. And that's all that I need for my argument. So essentially what he's doing is sort of just haggling about maybe it happened a little bit earlier and it happened a little bit quicker. And in reality, the only real difference, and it's not really a logically important difference, but the difference between our two accounts is just that he thinks that this shift happened in around 381 AD. So he thinks that it began a little bit earlier than Augustine. And he thinks that it happened just all of a sudden. He thinks it happened in basically an impossibly short frame, a time frame. Whereas I think this happened over centuries that people started kind of changing the way they talked. It happened more quickly in the West than in the East. And I think that it ultimately also doesn't probably matter because it probably just represents two different ways of talking and not two different substantive views. But anyway, regardless, even if it was the case that it happened all kind of around 381, that wouldn't matter. Right, that wouldn't actually make any difference. So let's go on. A better description for my narrative then, I think, would just be something like a later and slower development narrative. So I think that the beginning happens later with Augustine by a few decades, and I think that it happens slower. A better description for Dale's view might be something like the imperial enforcement and worldwide collapse narrative, or the impossibly short time frame narrative or something like that. The difference is just he locates the beginning of this change earlier and he thinks that it happened in this rapid pace. To me, that seems like basically a kind of rehashing of the great apostasy mythology that certain Protestant groups have had in the past. But instead of blaming everything on Constantine, which I think has kind of been played out in scholarship. It's not really tenable anymore. I think he's just kind of shifting things to Theodosius. And I just noted, I imagine that the same thing will happen there, that it, once people start looking into the history behind it, or if they start looking into that history, they'll realize that that's not a very plausible narrative and probably shift it up to Justinian after that. And then when that plays out, maybe Leo the Wise or, you know, whatever, it'll just kind of shift up. The reason that there's a number of reasons I think that narrative is problematic. We'll talk later about this, and I'll let Skylar kind of get on to problems with the argument. But I think that it raises more questions ultimately than it answers. But so that's kind of a clarification of what my actual view is. I just think that the change happens later and slower. I don't really care whether it has anything to do with the West. I think it does, but that's not really essential to the view. And that kind of brings us to the next issue that I guess I'll let Skylar talk about, which is what's the motivation for this shift on Dale's narrative? So in a historical narrative, we want textual evidence that it happened, but we also want to kind of have some sort of explanation of what the motive is.
For in thee have we trusted. Be not very angry with us, neither remember our iniquity.
Some of these details here, Bo and I have actually gone over in quite a bit of depth to make some different points in a presentation that we did called The Unfinished Business of Unitarian Theorizing. That's up on my website and blog, and Bo has those posted, and they're on YouTube. So some material here I'm going to briefly go over to get into, you know, critiquing the motive for Dr. Tuggy's Nicene development narrative. So the motive, what really brings around the shift around 381, as Tuggy says, is Basil's floundering around and failing to have an answer to the constant nagging that follows him about tritheism. The first thing to note is that in the paper, though, there's not really any sort of evaluation or a description of how Basil responds to these. He just says that this is something that is thrown at Basil a number of times and it keeps cropping up, and he tries a few different responses, and in the end, none of them really work. So it's left to the Gregories, Gregory of Nyssa, his brother, and Gregory Nazianzen, to respond to this. And what we want to point out is that on Tuggy's own definitions, particularly coming from his article on counting gods, it seems like Basil does have a response to the tritheism objection. And that paper on counting gods, that's also in Theologica, like the paper that we're discussing here has been, and it's also open access, so anybody can check that one out. Now, in that paper, there's some diagrams that he has given, and I've talked a little bit directly with Dr. Tuggy about this just to make sure I was understanding what he was saying there. This, according to that paper, is correct in terms of a definition of God. S is a God if and only if S is an ultimate deity. And in the paper, he spells out some conditions for what a deity is. He says that it's a self, something that's more powerful than an ordinary human being, at least with regard to actions humans normally care about. Like, nobody's really going to care if there's some being that can make, you know, the perfectly toasted marshmallow or whatever. That's just not something we really care about. And then the third condition is that a deity has supernatural power. Now, for ultimate, he doesn't spell it out exactly, but he gives us enough things for us to work with. And he says that roughly an ultimate is a farthest back being. Or one way that I would sort of summarize that and put that is that to which there's no explanatory priority. The ultimate doesn't have some sort of explanation before it. So one way that Bo and I have glossed this and put it in that presentation that I mentioned is that an ultimate is an Ase deity, or you could also say the sole Ase deity. So an ultimate, there's only going to be one of those, as Tuggy mentions. And so that's why I'm saying now here, the sole Ase deity. Now, there's a number of things that I've found, and I think where Basil is saying that the Father is the sole Ase deity, or claims, he makes claims that imply this. And I'll mention some, read snippets of others. So One of these comes from his collection of letters in letter 52. He makes the point, actually, that the homoousion entails causal order. For things which are brothers to one another cannot be called alike in substance. And in the Greek there, this homoousia, as some have supposed. On the contrary, when both the cause and that which has its origin from that cause are of the same nature, then they are called alike in substance. So that's really interesting. So brothers aren't alike in substance. Brothers aren't homoousios. Bo and I aren't homoousios. Only where there's causal order, Basil is saying, does that term apply. So I am homoousios with my children, and because there's a causal ordering there. So there's other things that come up in his letters as well. That one's particularly striking, and it's worth bringing out because if there's a causal order, and if the son is homoousios with the father, that means that the father is his cause, or that within the Trinity, the father is the first cause.
Yeah, one reason that's important too is Dale at one point in the paper, he quotes something from Basil where Basil says, you know, the ousia has the same relation to the hypostasis as general to particular. And Dale kind of glosses that as, okay, ousia is just a universal. And then he goes from that to that homoousios just means that they share a universal. And the problem is that that is not what Basil means by homoousios. It's not all that Basil means by homoousios. Now, that is roughly what you will see in some later authors. So if you fast forward several centuries to John of Damascus, for example, John of Damascus will say, yeah, all cows are homoousios and all dogs are homoousios and so forth. So it's true that later authors will gloss homoousios as just kind of same type of thing, same species. I think Gregory of Nyssa does that. But Basil is working with, you know, particularly a kind of older definition of homoousios, where essentially the import of it is the monarchy of the father. And I was going to just interject with something about his correspondence with Apollinaris too. So epistles 361 to 364 in Basil, actually, so this is a correspondence that he had with Apollinaris, who famously later became this big Christological heretic. But before that happened, what a lot of people don't know is that Apollinaris was actually a very well-respected theologian and was unquestionably thought to be orthodox because of his views on the Trinity, which were orthodox, but people didn't realize he had this kind of heretical Christology that came out later. And Apollinaris was at the First Ecumenical Council himself, and so Basil at one point, probably in the 360s, sent a letter to him to ask him for his explanation and interpretation of the word homoousios, because Basil had some reservations about it. Look, if you read Epistle 361, it looks like Basil thinks he's not quite sure that there's a good way to interpret homoousios, and he thinks that maybe homoios or homoousios or homoios kat ousion, similar according to essence, would be a better way to put things. Epistle 362 is what's really important. So this is Apollinaris's response to Basil. And by the way, if you have kind of some older editions of these things, they might say that these letters are spurious, they're not authentic. For a good while, the scholarly consensus was that they were not authentic. G.L. Prestige in the, I think, 50s or 60s wrote a kind of a long paper. It ended up being published as a short book posthumously. It wasn't quite finished, but when he died. But anyway, it has convinced most people since then that actually they are authentic. Lewis Ayers is convinced by his argument that these epistles are authentic. I think John Baer takes them to be authentic too. I just saw recently someone came out with a stylometric analysis of these epistles from Basil compared to his Contra Eunomius, where he says there's, you know, vocabulary and stylistic kind of similarities between them. So the scholarly consensus seems to be that they actually are authentic. So if you find those older versions of it, that's kind of outdated scholarship. But anyway, what Apollinaris responds, the way he responds to Basil is he says, essentially, there's another way to understand the word homoousios besides thinking of it as like there's a platonic form that they both share, or they're made out of some kind of material stuff and it's the same stuff, or, you know, you broke one off from another or something like that. He says that homoousios basically can mean something like in a lineage. And so he gives analogies to Adam and David. He says, in this sense, both two and more are homoousios, just as all we men are Adam, being one, and the son of David is David, as being the same as David his father. So what does he mean there? Well, in Hebrew, you may know, human beings are just referred to as Adam. So, for example, when it says to Hezekiah, thou art man and not God, what it literally says is thou art Adam and not El. So in Hebrew, you would call men all Adam because they're descended from Adam. And also you can call any of the Davidic kings David because they're part of that Davidic dynasty. You might think, I mean, we don't quite talk that way in English, but you might make a sort of analogy to something like, if I have children, you know, we can talk about they are all Bransons. We're all Bransons because we all derive from one patriarch, right? So there's one Branson who's the father, and they all kind of derive from him. So, and actually this goes back, this is, I think, something that's there in Aristotle at some place. But in any case, he says, just as you rightly say that the son is homoousios with the father, for not otherwise would the son be God. He says, so in, you know, that you wouldn't say that the son is theos in any other sense, since the father is confessed as the one and only God. Just as, no doubt, there is both one Adam, the first of the human race, and one David, the first of a race of kings. So in other words, Apollinaris, and it's worth reading that whole epistle, but Apollinaris's explanation of homoousios is just that it's kind of a way of asserting the monarchy of the father. So to say that the son is homoousios with the father is to say that that is his source, in kind of the way that Adam is our source, or that David is the source of the Davidic dynasty. And so that just kind of goes to show you that you can't just kind of assume that everybody's kind of using words in the same way or whatever. You have to go in and look at the evidence and look at how they are using these words. So another just tidbit, if famously Athanasius uses the word homoousios, what is it, 350 or so somewhere in that neighborhood. Actually, I was looking at the other day that if you look at all of the instances of that word from the fourth century, something like 25% of them are just Athanasius alone. But point being, he says that frequently, that the son is homoousios with the father. He never says that the father is homoousios with the son. Just seems like that's inexplicable unless he thought of this as an asymmetric relation, right? He can't just think of it as sharing a universal, right? That they're just two things of the same species. Athanasius is still thinking about homoousios in the sense of derivation from a single source. And Apollinaris seems to have thought of it that way. And so those are both guys who were at the First Ecumenical Council. And Basil, it looks like, accepts that. And that is why Basil felt like he was able to change from the homoiousian position to the homoousian position, is because he felt like that was a reasonable explanation. And so when Dale goes on and says, okay, well, Basil's just got a universal here, and so he's just kind of clearly a tritheist, there's much more to the story than just that.
Yeah, so we have mentioned some things in the epistles, now some things from Basil's homilies. So there's a translation of a couple of these, and there's more than just stuff related to the Trinity in there, and I think it's a great book. Volume 47, Popular Patristic Series, is a translation of a number of Basil's homilies by Del Cogliano, and that's where I'm pulling some of the information here. So in this next quote, this is out of homily 15, which in that book I mentioned is called On Faith, Section 2. Basil, he starts this off and he's asking everybody to, in their minds, to transcend and go beyond all of created reality. And then this is what he says next. There, or beyond all things in creation, we find Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, the uncreated nature, the lordly dignity, the natural goodness. The Father is the principle of all, the cause of all being for whatever exists, the root of the living. From him proceeded the source of life, the wisdom, the power, and the indistinguishable image of the invisible God. The Son, who was begotten from the Father, the living Word, he who is both God and with God, he who is, not adventitious, he who exists before the ages, not a late acquisition, he who is Son, not something possessed, he who is Maker, not something made, he who is Creator, not creature, who is everything that the Father is. Note that I have said Son and Father. And then he's going to go on from there. So the Father is the principle of all, the cause of all being for whatever exists. In homily 24, which in that same volume is called the Homily Against the Sabellians, Animoians, and the Pneumatomachians, this is in section 3, and I've got a couple of quotes from this one. Section 3, there is one God because there is one Father, but the Son is also God, and there are not two gods because the Son has identity with the Father. For I do not behold one divinity in the Father and another in the Son, nor is one nature this and the other that. So he's using as a part of his argument against these other groups that there's one God because there's one Father. And here's what he says in the section following this one. But when I say one substance, do not think the two are separated off from one, but that the Son has come to subsist from the Father, his principle. And in the Greek there, that's his principle is his arche. And later on, he actually brings up the tritheism objection, the same section 4, some intervening material. And then he says, still you say he preaches two gods. He proclaims polytheism. And this is his answer. There are not two gods because there are not two fathers. Whoever introduces two first principles preaches two gods. Such is Marcion and anyone similar to him in impiety. So from the homilies, we gather that the Father is the principle of all, the cause of being of whatever exists. The Son subsists from the Father who is his principle. And there aren't two gods because there is only one first principle, and that here is going to be the Father. Now, that seems to satisfy the definition that we gave earlier, that on Tuggy's definition of God, that the Father, according to Basil, is the ultimate deity. If that's the case, then we no longer have a motive for his historical narrative. And the reason that is because it looks like by satisfying that definition that Tuggy gives, Basil does have a response to the tritheism objection. It's that the one God is the Father for the reasons that he gives. And a lot of it has to do with the Son coming from the Father. It has to do with eternal generation and really what he thinks. And maybe this isn't the way that maybe it's often explained or maybe glossed in contemporary Christianity, but when it comes to the homoousion, how he understands that itself as well. So,
in case people are not maybe following the argument, or just to kind of elaborate on it, the point is whenever you offer a narrative about someone's development in their thinking, right, you always want there to be a motive for why they changed their mind. So let me give you an example. A common view in ancient philosophy is that Socrates and maybe Plato early on thought of the mind and the will in this very simplistic way. So just if you believe something is good, you'll do it. And if you believe it's bad, you just won't. But that raises some problems, right? Which is that sometimes we do things that we know we shouldn't, right? Sometimes we do know something is really wrong, but we do it anyway. So weakness of will. Most people believe that Plato, at least later on, developed this more complex view of psychology, the tripartite theory of the soul. That story wouldn't make any sense unless there was a problem with the simple psychology. If the simple psychology was perfectly fine, then it wouldn't make any sense for him to have changed his mind. Like, why would you develop a more complicated theory unless it was solving a problem that you had, right? In this case, weakness of will couldn't be accounted for on this very simple model, so he makes this more complicated model. And of course, we also want textual evidence that that actually happened, right? So we want to be able to look and see, yeah, it does look like in these early dialogues, he says things, it sounds like the mind is really simple, and then these later ones, it sounds like he's got this more complicated theory, right? You want all of that together. If there's no textual evidence that the change actually happened, then that's not a very good, you know, historical hypothesis. Or if there's some tension, you know, between some earlier and later dialogues, but there's not any reason why he would have changed his mind, then that's not a, I mean, we don't have a good explanation, right? It doesn't make sense. We probably would just want to go in and see, like, well, how can we reconcile these, you know? Or if we do think that he changed his mind, we really need to know why. And what we're saying here is that the motive that Dale is presented for why the Gregories come along and change this view that they've inherited from Basil is, he says that Basil's view is just blatantly tritheistic, right? So that's the motive, is supposed to be that they're fixing this problem. So what we're pointing out is that actually Dale doesn't give any analysis of why we should think that Basil's a tritheist. He just kind of asserts that it obviously is the case. But if you actually look at what Basil actually says about the tritheism objection, Dale should be saying that there isn't any problem with tritheism. He should be saying that Basil is not a tritheist and was never a tritheist, because what Basil actually says about the tritheism objection is something that is exactly fits into Dale's own categories of what counts as monotheism and what counts as tritheism. So in other words, what Dale himself would have to say is that you would be a tritheist only if all three persons were a se. But if the Father is the source of the Son and the Spirit, then he would have to say that that is a view on which there's only one God, and that's the Father. And lo and behold, when you go and look at Basil, he does say that the Father is the source of the Son and the Spirit, and he says exactly that his response to the tritheism objection is that there's only one God because there's only one Father. So it's just literally what Dale would want to see, and that's exactly what we do see.
And deliver us from our enemies, for thou art our God.
Now that we've talked a bit about the motive for Tuggy's Nicene development narrative, we want to discuss some of the textual evidence that Tuggy gives and give some responses to those. Where I'd like to begin is with a claim that Tuggy makes with regard to Gregory of Nyssa's Great Catechism, or the Catechetical Discourse. He says in chapter 3, sections 1 through 3, that Gregory makes an argument that implies that God is tripersonal. And he also says that Nyssa develops Basil's rhetorical portrayal of Nicene theology as a happy medium between Jewish monotheism and Greek polytheism. So let's read sections 2-3 here, which is a little bit long. And then I want to give how what Tuggy says in response to it. So section 2 says, "For in hypostasis, the spirit is one thing and the word another. And another again is he to whom the word and spirit belong. But whenever you understand the distinction in these, again, the unity of nature does not admit partition, so that neither is the might of the monarchy split, being cut up into differing divinities, nor does the discourse agree with Jewish teaching. But the truth passes through the mean of the two suppositions, casting down each of the heresies and accepting what is useful from each. For the teaching of the Jew is overturned both by the acceptance of the word and by faith in the spirit, while the Hellenist polytheistic error is destroyed, the unity of nature abolishing the fantasy of multiplicity. And again, once more, from the Jewish supposition, let the unity of nature remain, and from Hellenism, only the distinction of hypostases, each correspondingly healing the other's impious conjecture. For just as the number of the Trinity is a healing for those in error about the one, the principle of unity is a healing for those whose thought is scattered in a multitude of gods." There are a couple of square bracket additions there from the translator, but this is how Tuggy explains this chapter of the Great Catechism. He says, "What are the Jews correct about? The existence of exactly one God. In Gregory's theology, quote, the unity of the square brackets divine nature just is the uniqueness of God. What are the Jews wrong about? How many persons are in God? They have only the Father, but there are two others in addition to him. In contrast, the Greeks are right that there is more than one divine person, but they're wrong about the number of gods. So the happy medium is only one God, partially agreeing with the Jews, in whom there are three persons, partially agreeing with the Greeks. This is an argument that Basil couldn't and didn't make, as it's a properly Trinitarian, tripersonal God-involving argument, despite his fondness for happy medium rhetoric." So not only does this section of the Great Catechism to Tuggy say, or imply rather, that God is tripersonal, but it's an argument he says that Basil couldn't have made. And I think that that at face value is disputable based off of a homily that we've already seen some sections from, namely homily 24, which, if you recall from a bit earlier, is the one against the Sabellians, Anamoyans, and Pneumatomachians. So I want to read some sections here and then just bring out some similarities between them to see that there is a similarity of language. And not only that, but it looks to me, and I'd like to hear reasons for thinking otherwise, they're making the same argument. So in section 2 of homily 24, Basil says this: "Listen to this, Anamoyan, I and the Father are one. And you, Sabellius, listen to this. I have come from the Father, and I go to him. Let each of you be healed of his particular wound from the teaching of the gospel. One of you should understand that their unity is a question of indistinguishability of nature. The other, that I have come from him and I go to him, is a question of the distinction of the persons." Also, in a section that we've already read a little bit of, but I'll go on and show how he's making a similar point. In section 3, he says, "There's one God because there's one Father. But the Son is also God, and there are not two gods because the Son has identity with the Father. For I do not behold one divinity in the Father and another in the Son, nor is one nature this and the other that. So then, in order to make clear for you the distinctness of the persons, count the Father by himself and the Son by himself. But in order to avoid secession into polytheism, confess one substance in both. In this way, both Sabellius falls and the Anomoian will be shattered. So, of course, in homily 24 here, Basil's arguing against Sabellius and the Anomoians. However, what he's doing is he's linking the error of Judaism with Sabellianism and the error of the Hellenists or the polytheists with the Anomoians. And that's not just a point that I noticed and that I am bringing out here. This is actually what Del Cogliano says in the introduction to his translation of this homily. He says this, "In this homily, Basil polemically presents his own doctrine of the Trinity as the middle way between the extreme viewpoints of the Sabellians and Anomoians, who are depicted as attempting to reintroduce into Christianity, respectively, Jewish denial of the Son of God and Hellenic polytheism." So, in fact, we don't even have to go beyond the introductory paragraphs of this homily to see exactly what Del Cogliano is talking about, because Basil himself explicitly connects the Sabellians with Judaism and also connects who he's calling those who preach the unlike or the Anomoians with those who are introducing Hellenic teaching. Now, I want to take a closer look at some of those cross-references between the Great Catechism and what we've seen in the homilies here. In the Great Catechism, Gregory of Nyssa says, according to the Jewish conception, let the unity of nature stand. And what he says to the Anomoians in section 2 of homily 24 is they need to consider that the unity is a question of indistinguishability of nature. In the Great Catechism, Gregory of Nyssa says that they also need to hold to the Hellenistic idea of the distinction as to persons. And Basil in homily 24, section 2, says that the Sabellians need to realize the question of the distinction of persons. And we can do that. It's the same. If you put them right side by side, it looks like they're making the same exact argument. Now, remember, this is an argument that Tuggy says Basil couldn't and didn't make, as it's a properly Trinitarian or tripersonal God-involving argument. So what I think Tuggy owes us here is a textual analysis of the arguments to show how Gregory of Nyssa's involves a tripersonal God, but Basil's doesn't. I mean, at face value, it looks like they're making the same argument. And if they are, if it's the case that, you know, maybe Gregory of Nyssa is making some other points here in relation to this, and maybe elsewhere in his works he is developing this happy medium way of putting things, at least with regard to how Tuggy has put it in his paper, this doesn't look like evidence that Gregory of Nyssa has the tripersonal God theory as opposed to what Basil was holding. In fact, if anything, it looks like they're able to make those same arguments, perhaps because they, in fact, do have the same idea of God.
Based on my reading of Gregory of Nyssa, I would say, largely, at least the way that he conceived of what he was doing, is he wanted to just kind of defend his brother's theology and you know, kind of his legacy or so forth. So I do think that there are cases where Gregory of Nyssa, you know, sort of improves on Basil and does some things that are novel and so forth. But largely, I think he mostly did just want to kind of be repeating his brother's theology and sort of cleaning things up and so forth. So it's really not surprising to me at all to see in Gregory of Nyssa's Great Catechism that he says, yeah, the doctrine of the Trinity is this kind of middle way between Judaism and Hellenism, and then find out that actually he's just getting that from Basil. So yeah, I mean, I think Dale's claim that you know, Basil could not possibly have made such an argument because, you know, he didn't have a fully Trinitarian view yet. Well, but then there you go. You find it there in him after all.
And we call upon thy name, both now and ever and unto ages of ages. Amen.
Maybe we can go on and talk about one thing that Andrew Redigalwitz points out in his response to Dale is that all of the kind of long quotations that Dale gives to support his reading of the Cappadocians, particularly the Gregories, they all kind of, like, he'll give this long quote and then he just inserts his own interpretation in square brackets. But if you take out the insertions that Dale has put into the text, they don't actually directly support his claims. So it's this kind of weird thing where it, like, if you just looked at the text, you wouldn't have any evidence, but then Dale just inserts his interpretation into the text and then sort of acts like that's evidence for his interpretation. So it's this kind of weird circular thing where the evidence for the interpretation is the interpretation. But there's no actual just direct textual evidence. So there's no place where he just quotes the Cappadocians saying the Trinity is the one God or something like that. There's a number of things. So one thing I wanted to point out too, this is not in his paper, but it was in his podcast response that he made to my original podcast back in 2018. In that podcast, he quotes a section from St. John of Damascus on heresies, and it's from Heresy 103, or really, I think more precisely, the epilogue that's contained in Heresy 103. That actually doesn't exist. So, and I've kind of recused myself from making any big editorial decisions on his paper since it was kind of largely in response to me. I just let the other co-editors kind of handle that. But I did kind of fight on that point, and they agreed with me that we shouldn't let that be published because there is no Heresy 103. What actually has happened is Dale just consulted the English translation by Chase from 1958, where he was just translating whatever was in Patrologia Graeca, which those are not typically necessarily very reliable manuscripts, but they're sometimes all people would have. Anyway, the critical edition of John of Damascus didn't come out until the following year in 1959, and Cotter's critical edition does not include Heresy 103 because it's just not, it wasn't authentic. A lot of times, by the way, in critical editions, if there is some kind of question about whether something is authentic or not, a lot of times people just have this scholarly apparatus where, you know, there's some kind of system of square brackets and angle brackets and things where they'll, you know, they'll kind of set certain text off to let you know that it's there in some manuscripts but not in others, or maybe it's questionable or whatever. Cotter just didn't even include Heresy 103 because it was so clear that it just wasn't authentic and no one thinks it's authentic. But Dale doesn't know that, and so he just kind of assumed that it was correct. He didn't bother to look it up in the critical edition of the Greek. I don't think he probably even reads Greek. You know, that he doesn't really keep up with the scholarship. I pointed that out to him, and he kind of tried to fight about it with a quote from some book that actually said the opposite of what he wanted it to say. It was still saying that was not authentic. So that's one issue, is that he sometimes is appealing to things that don't exist. Some other non-existent kind of evidence that he brings up: Gregory Nazianzen. There was a section from Oration 31, a quote that he gave from Oration 31, section 17, where it says something about, like, what, you know, the Trinity is what we worship, or we worship him, or something like that. But that's actually not in the Greek. It's just something that was, again, it's supplied by the translator, because the Greek expression is just something there's no equivalent for in English. We can't kind of make the same construction in English. And so translators routinely just sort of supply a pronoun. Dale has this kind of argument about pronouns that I don't think is even really a valid argument in the first place, but he thinks that the pronouns are really important. But the pronouns are actually not there in Greek. It's something that was just, again, supplied by the English translator. But since he's not checking the actual original Greek text, he didn't know that. And that's, I think, Andrew Redigall, which pointed that out too. There's another one in the same oration, 31, section 33, where he thinks that there's a pronoun there, him, that refers back to the Trinity. I think that's in a doxology, like, to him be glory, you know, now and ever and until ages of ages or something. And the way, again, it's just the way it's written in English, it might look like it's referring back to the Trinity. But in Greek, the grammar of it can't refer to the Trinity because it's the wrong grammatical gender. It has to refer back to the Father. So actually the pronoun that he thinks is referring to the Trinity, and that's kind of this, you know, smoking gun that he must really think that God is the Trinity, well, it actually refers back to the Father. There were some other things. He left in some references to John of Damascus, but they were not really clear. So he references Book 1, Chapter 8, which is like goes on for pages and pages and pages. And he doesn't say what part of that he thinks, you know, shows that John of Damascus is calling the one God, the Trinity, instead of the Father. There's plenty of things in that section where he does identify God with the Father, but Dale just kind of made this vague reference, and it's totally unclear, you know, what part of this long section he had in mind. There's another one like that with Book 2, Chapter 5, says that we worship one God in Trinity and unity, literally in the monad and in the triad. But it's not clear whether John of Damascus meant to identify the Trinity with God or what, especially given that John of Damascus is explicit that he sometimes uses the word God. He uses it in two different ways or two different senses. He says in one sense it refers to a person, and then in another sense it can refer to the nature. So it's not really, it's just completely unclear what the import of that was supposed to be. He's got another quote from Oration 40. He quotes Gregory Nazianzen as saying, "These three have one common name, the Godhead, or the Holy Trinity." And so the way that Dale quotes that, it makes it kind of look like Nazianzen is identifying the Trinity with the Godhead. And then later, Dale kind of claims that Nazianzen identifies God with the Godhead, which I don't think is exactly right. But anyway, if he identifies God with the Godhead and then Godhead with the Holy Trinity, then you can kind of infer, okay, he must be identifying God with the Trinity. The problem is that Dale literally has this ellipsis where he skips over 460 words of text in the English translation. So he skips over like a page and a half, and on the following page, Nazianzen says, "These three have one common name, the Godhead." And then it's dot, 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 and a page and a half later, he says, "The rest you shall learn within the church by the grace of the Holy Trinity." And Dale just has kind of like dot, 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 the Trinity, and makes it look like he's just kind of saying, you know, Godhead or the Holy Trinity. But in reality, he went a page and a half later and just kind of snagged this reference to the Trinity from a completely different paragraph that doesn't have anything to do with the Godhead or whatever, which I thought was just kind of pretty extreme. Another thing that he does, so he quotes Oration 42, which is Nazianzen's farewell address to the council at the 381 council before he left that. And he says that there, Nazianzen describes the Trinity as a single recipient of worship. But actually, Nazianzen never says anything about the Trinity being a single recipient of worship or anything like that. It's just, again, that he refers to the Trinity with a singular pronoun, which Dale kind of assumes means that he conceives of it as a single entity. But in reality, the problem with that argument is that that's just Greek grammar. You can't in Greek call the Trinity they, because trios is singular. So just like in English, we say, my country, tis of thee, not tis of ye. Or we say things like, the government is corrupt. We don't say the government are corrupt, because those are singular. And that's just how grammar works. So in the same way that grammatical gender doesn't necessarily always map onto physical gender, grammatical singularity and plurality, grammatical number, doesn't always map onto the actual number of a thing. So there are collective nouns where they're grammatically singular, but they're semantically plural, and there's the opposite of those two. If he was really consistent about this, this idea that anytime someone is referring to the Trinity with a singular pronoun, then they must conceive of it as a single being, then he would have to say that all of the pre-Nicene church fathers who ever talk about the Trinity, that they conceive of it in the same way, because when they refer to the Trinity, they refer to it in the singular, because again, that's just the grammar of it. In fact, the Philo, the Jewish philosopher from the first century, he does this when he's referring to the patriarchs. So he talks about the triad of Enosh, Enoch, and Noah, and then he talks about the triad of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob as two trinities, literally in Greek, and he refers back to them with singular pronouns. But, you know, is Dale going to say that Philo believed in a tri-personal patriarch, that he believed that Enosh and Enoch and Noah somehow, you know, formed this one Voltron-like entity or whatever because he refers to them with a singular pronoun? Well, of course not, right? We know that that's just the way grammar works. And so it just means that they had correct grammar, not that they had any particular metaphysical commitments. Another thing that's really odd about his reference to Oration 42 there, just at the end where he's got this, you know, pronoun that doesn't really prove anything, he didn't mention that oration, Oration 42, is literally the only time in Gregory Nazianzen's entire corpus that he ever uses the word tripersonal. So it's the only time that he ever used the word tripersonal in anything that he ever wrote. And he just ridicules it. He ridicules the idea. He says, you know, he considers this objection that maybe he's talking about something like, quote, a man with three faces. And he just says, perish the thought. So he says that's a ridiculous idea. So he's basically addressing almost exactly the same analogy that William Lane Craig gives for his view about the Trinity, right? So William Lane Craig gives this analogy to Cerberus, the three-headed dog, you know, from Greek mythology. So it's almost the same thing, right? A dog with three heads, a man with three faces. And Gregory Nazianzen says, no, that's absolutely not what I believe. So if that's what Dale means by a tripersonal God, if he's thinking about something like William Lane Craig's view, the only time Gregory Nazianzen ever actually discusses that sort of view, he actually repudiates it. And then finally, I just wanted to mention that if you actually, as far as actual textual evidence goes, if you go through and do a search through all of the Cappadocians for the words Trinity and Theos and the definite article, and that's in Basil or any of the Gregories, depending on how wide you set the search parameters, it'll come up with maybe 10 to 20 hits on each author, and they're all false positives. So you can go through and see it's, you know, the definite article is over in one sentence and Trinity is over in another, or, you know, God is over here and then it's in a different phrase that you have a reference to the Trinity or something. So you can kind of, you know, fairly quickly go through and see if they ever actually literally say the Trinity is the God or the God is the Trinity or anything like that. And the fact is that they just don't. And one thing, a reason I want to mention that is, so, you know, again, I just want to look at the reality philologically of, you know, do these guys ever actually say the Trinity is the one God? No, that doesn't happen until Augustine. And that's just a fact that no patristic scholar really disputes. They just don't say that. you know, you can try to make these arguments, these strained kind of, you know, things with pronouns or whatever, most of which either don't exist, like the fake quote from St. John of Damascus, or it's not really there in the Greek, like the various things about Gregory Nazianzen. But one thing I would say is it's a really interesting double standard here, because biblical Unitarians will say frequently, hey, if this was such an important doctrine to, you know, to the New Testament authors, surely at some point they would just explicitly come out and say God is the Trinity, right? They would just explicitly state it if it was that central to their view. Why not take that same attitude towards the Church Fathers, right? Why not take that same attitude towards St. Basil or Gregory of Nyssa or Gregory Nazianzen, that if it was so central to their view that you need to identify God with the Trinity, why don't they ever say it, right? I mean, surely at some point they could say it at least once, right? But they don't. So you kind of have to, I think, make a choice. If you're going to say that, you know, if something's really important, you'd probably state it explicitly so that you can say, okay, well, it doesn't say that explicitly in the Bible. Well, then you're going to have to admit that it's not there in the Cappadocians, and so that just clearly is not an important issue for them. On the other hand, if you're going to try to kind of look around for pronouns and little hints and allegations about, you know, maybe they really sort of thought about it this way, then you're going to have to deal with those the sorts of things that certain Trinitarian apologists do with, you know, let us make man in our own image, and why is, you know, God in Hebrew plural, but the nouns are singular, and this sort of thing. That, you know, I know that most biblical Unitarians, and certainly Dale, you know, they just don't take those sorts of arguments seriously. I think that they shouldn't take those arguments seriously. I think those are flimsy arguments, but I think that they're, I think that we should not have a double standard. I think that we should demand clear evidence regardless of what text we're talking about. So bottom line, Dale's argument provides no real motive for why there would be a change, because Basil, on Dale's own definitions, does not count as a tritheist at all. And he gives us no actual textual evidence that there actually was any such change.
That concludes our podcast. I hope you found it interesting and found something helpful in our discussion. The chanting you've heard throughout this podcast is a traditional Orthodox chant, Have Mercy on Us, recorded by a band called The Music Room. You can find them at themusicroom.bandcamp.com, where you can download this track as a single and also check out their EPs, Live While You're Alive and Wolves Without Teeth. Until next time, through the prayers of our Holy Fathers, O Lord Jesus Christ, our God, have mercy on us and save us. Amen.
Open unto us the door of thy loving kindness. O blessed Theotokos, so that hoping in thee we may not perish, but through thee may be delivered from adversities. For thou art the salvation of Christ.